Good morning and welcome. My name is Keith McGee, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadoc Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Dr. Barbara Reynolds. Please join me in thanking our musicians today, Emma Ritera, for their wonderful music. For many years, the Monadoc Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadoc region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire us on a local, national, and global issues. As many of you know, the Lyceum's programs are recorded for New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's talk may be heard on NHPR 2 Sundays from now at 10 p.m. The talk will also be available on our website, monadoclyceum.org, as a podcast within a few days. At the end of the presentation, in keeping with the Lyceum tradition, Dr. Reynolds has agreed to answer questions from the audience. The ushers will be collecting your questions towards the end of the talk. Please write them on the yellow cards provided. Following the program, you are invited to attend an informal reception in the parish hall, which is through the doors to your left. There you will have the opportunity to further engage in conversation with our speaker and to enjoy refreshments. In your pews, you will also find blue cards. We hope you will give us feedback on today's program and join our mailing and/or email list. You can either mail the blue cards to us or drop the blue cards in the bowls or along with contributions to the sustainability of the Lyceum. The Monadoc Summer Lyceum is supported entirely through contributions from audience members. We deeply appreciate your donations, which may be placed in the glass bowls in the church or in the parish hall. We thank you in advance for your generosity. Today we have with us Barbara Reynolds. She is most notably known as being on the founding editorial board of USA Today. She is the author of 8 books, a columnist, scholar, and ordained minister. She has won the Southern Christian Leadership Conference Drum Major for Justice Award and was inducted into the 29th annual Martin Luther King Jr. International College of Ministers and Laity at Morehouse College. She holds an undergraduate degree from The Ohio State University, a master's in religion from Howard University, and a doctor of ministry from United Theological Seminary. She is also notably known as being the first African woman to be a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Her body of work causes us to consider our own humanity in the quest for social justice, equality, and the understanding of how a loving God responds to on behalf of us all. Please help me welcome Dr. Barbara Reynolds.
Thank you. I want to thank Nancy Horowitz and the Lyceum for this opportunity to be part of the resurgence of Coretta Scott King. I'm talking to groups like this all over the United States. And it's great that at a time such as this that we will focus on the other half of the movement. We know about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. because there were many books about him. But for some reason, women are always the last ones to be written about. And so I'm here to thank you for being part of this research. Now, let me explain why I think it's so important. And maybe it's just me, but almost daily, I read the news, I look at the news, and I feel a sense of vileness and vulgarity, like all of a sudden, I'm living at the bottom of a sewer. I just read in USA Today a study that said 70% of those interviewed said our president, your president, is not a good role model for young people. And I might even say he's not a good role model for anybody. Young, old. And I don't, maybe there's a new slogan, let's make America gross again. And you know, I went through a period of hate and hostility. And I'm going to talk about how Coretta went through this. And I never thought I would see it again when Jewish cemeteries are being vandalized. When you see a four-letter word in the headlines in papers like the New York Times. When you have a man who demeans women. And we have girls. You know, we want to encourage to grow up to be great women and business women and ministers and teachers. And we have, you know, our president who demeans, and that sends the wrong signal to people. We have hate crimes that's going and growing. And this, all of this, see, I went through this in the 50s and the 60s. I was in the civil rights movement. And then we came a long way. But now it seems like we're going back down to the sewer again. But I know that if Coretta Scott King was here, she would not be shaking her head and saying, what should we do? There was 1.5 million women that came to Washington and around the country to march in protest after President Trump won the presidency, or won it. I'm not sure he really won it, but I'll say won it. Then we had a citizen revolt. Do you think we have health care now? They tried to take it away from the people who needed it. And if you don't think about what happens if you can't go to a doctor, if you don't have access to a doctor, some people will die. But there was a citizen's revolt. These senators could not get into their offices because some of us were there. We were laying down in the street. We were protesting. And I think that Coretta King would be so happy and proud of you because you know that we can win again. We do not have to sink into this morass. We got out of it once, and we can win. Are you agreeing with me? We can win again. Do you agree with me? We can win. We can win again. And so this brings me to this day. What's different? What's different, I think, is moral authority. What we don't see are the values that many of us thought that other people just took for granted. You know, we do not have to hate people that we want to change the system about. In the movement, we didn't hear hate. I mean, I was in the movement, and we wanted to change the system, but we didn't, you know, on the news today, the new communications director, he said what he wanted, he used the four-letter word, he said we want to kill the leakers. I mean, we didn't talk like, we didn't use violent speech, we didn't hate like the haters are doing today. So there is a resurgence. And Coretta King, she was the co-leader of the most successful non-violent movement that started right in a church, right in the church. And that's why I'm so glad that this movement, because I can see from the vitality, the looks on your faces, that you're going to be part of this new movement, that we've had enough, and we're going to do something about it. So that's a long way of saying how inspired I am that you have me here, and you want to hear more about an outstanding woman. She died on January 30th, 2006, but her legacy is much alive as a coalition builder, a strategist, and a moral voice. Who has the moral authority that you hear today? If you know, our pastors and preachers, but in the public square. I mean, who's talking about coming together that we're one people, that no matter what race, what religion you are, that we can make this country great again by including all of us in. I mean, where is that moral voice? One thing I learned about her is her courage. And that's what we need today, is courage. Let me take you back to when I met her. It was in about 74 or so. And at that time, she had a great reputation around the world as a peace activist. And when I met her, I began to see how courageous she was. Here she had a husband that she had to sacrifice. You know, just think about some of you who are married or have someone you love very greatly. And because you're standing up for social justice for all of us, there are threats on your life, and you have to think about it. One day I'm going to lose you, Martin. One day children, Yolanda, Martin, Dexter, Bernice, one day you won't have a father. And why won't you have a father? Because your father is standing up for the rights of people. And she had to go. They knew that sooner or later that the hate in this country would take his life. She had to hear the death threats at the Montgomery bus boycott. There was threats on her life every day. There was threats that if you don't get out of Montgomery, and you know what that Montgomery bus boycott was about, how all the blacks had to sit at the back of the bus. And if you didn't sit at the back of the bus, they could throw you off and beat you. But at some point, they said, enough is enough. And they walked for 381 days rather than ride in dignity. But they said that they were going to kill her. They were going to kill her daughter. And one night, she was sitting with a friend, and there was a big thud on the front porch. And then there was an explosion. The fire jumped up. And she had to run to the back to get the baby out the crib and see would they somebody there to just blow up the whole house. But she, can you imagine how you would feel if you had a baby in your arms and someone came and tried to blow up your house? You know? And the next day she had a decision. And I'm going to let my son, I should say it's my son, ask me some questions. But the next day she had a decision that would determine the future of the movement. Her father came, and Dr. King Sr., Martin Luther King's father, he was a big, impressive man, had a booming voice, something like yours, you know. And she's in her 20s, and he said, Coretta, you're going home, you're leaving, and he stood over her. And I know in her 20s, and this big man with a great reputation, she would shrink, would think they just blown off the front porch, and here comes this man saying, I'm taking you out of Montgomery. And she said, I'm not leaving Martin. She said, because I want you to know, I'm married to Martin, but I'm also married to the movement. What kind of courage is that? This is the kind of woman that we honor, and this is the kind of woman that even when they killed him, 3 days later, she went back to Memphis, and she led the march that resulted in her husband's death only a couple years later. And she continued for 39 years after his death. She marched for the labor movement. She fought for the gay rights movement. Even at that time, when most of the people around her was not for gay rights, she talked about how that she would not discriminate. And she fought this transgender movement. She would be there right now, fighting for all people to be able to serve in this country. And so I could go on and on about so much, but I want to make sure that I answer And you know why? The courage. I knew the courage. See, because in the 60s, I went south to try to work in the voter rights movement. I was, in fact, it was a Unitarian group that I first went south with. But I was a student at Ohio State University. And we didn't, see, they didn't tell us how bad things were. Our teachers didn't. Our parents didn't. So when I saw Selma, I saw men on horseback beating black people who were praying and walking and trying to get the vote. And I said, "What is? Why is that? What? It's strange to say you didn't know, but we didn't know." And so a group of us, a mixed group, whites, Hispanics, and African Americans, we wanted to investigate, but we didn't know if you had a black face or brown face, you could just be killed just for showing up. We were walking through the streets, and the town people came out from the stores, and we were waving because they thought that they were welcoming us. And we didn't know. So that night, the people we were staying with said, now, we were 20s, and they said, do not go out after dark. You know, stay in the house. And so being in 20s, what do you think we did? We said, let's go out and find some place where we can go dancing. So we saw this little sidewalk, and it was sort of in a rural place, and we got out of our cars and went in, and they said it was white, so we didn't think anything different. And the guys pulled the cord out of the sock and said, get them. And we jumped, oh my God, we said, and we jumped into the cars. We had a souped up jalopy, and we were trying to get away from them, which we did. The next day, they had a roadblock for us because we were trying to register people to vote. And so that's how I understood her courage, because when I got out of the South, I said, oh, you don't have to worry about me. I'm not coming back. So for years, I wouldn't come back, so I could understand. Here's a woman who's being threatened every day, and she never left, and she carried on the movement. It was difficult to stand up to people who want to kill you just because you show up with a brown or black face. No, I went on a little long.
Oh, please. Thank you. So one of the things that we know is that when you went to Ohio, the Ohio State University, you were told in the mid-60s, in the midst of the story that you've just shared with us, that a colored woman would never become a journalist. And yet Absolutely. You go on to write My Life, My Love, My Legacy, Coretta Scott King. What does it mean to you to actually have written the book itself?
Well, the first thing is for people who have been told that they can never do something. Dr. King used to say, the arc of the universe is wide, that always comes back towards justice. I also became the first African-American woman in 1996 to give the first convocation speech at Ohio State University. That's why I always have such hope, you know, because a movement like this can change things. To write a book about Coretta King was very difficult. It was probably the most difficult thing I ever have done. First of all, I had a lot of interference from the family. And I'm not going to harshly criticize them because, okay, suppose you have four children and here's someone writing about your mother. Each one of you is going to think a different way. And no matter what you do, you cannot please all of them. So at one point, the guys liked the idea of the book, had a wonderful contract that a publisher was going to give me, but Bernice King did not like it, so she sued me to stop. And so that was a problem. Then when she finally decided that she did like it, then here's the guys. So I had family squabbles. I was in court. But she had such an impression on me. I never met a woman like her. I mean, as long as I was with her, no matter how people acted. She don't say, we're not going to hate. She would repeat what Dr. King Sr. said. He said, I'll never let anyone make me stoop low enough to hate. I mean, she was so large, but she made me feel special. And so, and she had such dignity. You would never think that as a child she had to pick cotton in order to earn the money to go to school. When you saw her very dignified as an opera singer and all of that. And I just couldn't stop. No matter what happened, I had to grow because she was a very spiritual person at a time when I was not spiritual at all. And yeah, I had to, she always talked to me when she was building the King Center. She showed me the blueprints in the 70s, and she talked about how she wanted the King Center to be like a mini United Nations where all people would come and be happy and work together. And you know, and I said, well, have you seen something like this? How do you know you can do this? She said, the Holy Spirit shows me. And she prayed before she did anything. And this is why it's so important that we know that she was a woman whose life was filled with prayer from a child. And so, and I never will forget when I used to come and stay with her. And I'm a minister now. I can't believe how patient she was with me. Because I come to I stay at her house. She'd say, Barbara, we're going to go to church tomorrow. I said, Mrs. King, do I have to go? Can you imagine? Can you imagine? But she had patience with me. And another thing why I wanted to do the book, because as a reporter and with the papers, I would always see how the press would do. They would, anytime she would do something, they would say the wife of, the mother of, but never recognized her as a leader. For 39 years, she led the movement. And it just, you know, she used to say to me, she said, do you ever think they'll see me? You ever think? And she said, well, maybe they can't because my husband was so large. So this is why we say it's time to see Coretta. Because she wasn't ashamed, you know, of being the woman who stood behind Dr. King, beside, not behind, beside. But she was a leader in her own right. And it troubled me that they didn't know her.
So tell us, who was Coretta Scott before King? We hear about the picking. Who was Coretta Scott? Who was the Scott family? Can you put that into
context? Yeah, they were a very, first of all, religious group of people. They lived outside of Marion, Alabama. Now, Marion was only 7,500 people, I think, even now. So they lived outside of there, but they were landowners. And they were very independent people because they had their own land. That's why she always proudly said Scott, because they had their land. They worked that land. Their mother had a dream of her going to college. And
when she was picking cotton, she was picking cotton from the land that they owned.
No, not really, because they didn't have cotton. They had pine. They grew mostly pine.
Okay.
She was hired out to people who grew cotton, and she picked what, maybe a bag or two a day, each bag. I think she got 2 cents for it. It was very, very little. But she believed, they had a faith that someday things would change. And it did. Her mother, her father was incredible. When she was 15 years old, somebody burnt their father's home down completely. And of course, we know who it was. And she couldn't call, the family couldn't call the police because they wouldn't come. They couldn't call the fire people. Well, they didn't have telephones, first of all. But if they had, they wouldn't come. But after the house was burnt down, her father had them get together in a circle and pray to forgive those who did it. And then somebody burnt her father's business down. He got another business. They burnt that down. And the third business was a grocery store. They allowed that to happen. But to see that the people were surrounded by hate, that come out of this situation as beacons of love, it was incredible.
Thank you. So she goes off to college
mm-hmm.
and on to Boston to train as a classical musician. And I understand that's where she met Martin.
Yeah. And, you know, I try to look at this situation. You know, I sit back. I say, how did that happen? Yeah, and I know you know, feel a divine dimension working some way that somehow you can't explain something unless you can say it must have been the will of God. God, how do you get someone from the backwoods of Alabama and some other person from the backwoods, really, of Atlanta, yeah, of Georgia, in Atlanta, and how did they get at the same place at the same time, unless you think God, because she came, see, she had the gift to sing. She sang as a child. Her and her sister got a scholarship to go to Antioch, and she did that as a singer. Then she had tutors who saw that she had a voice like an angel, and so they worked it and worked it, so she got a scholarship to the New England Conservatory of Music, where she had to scrub floors and everything because she had no money. But so here comes Dr. King. He's at Boston University getting his PhD in systematic theology. He's here, over here. She's here, over there. But there was a matchmaker in between. You ever known the kind of people who always just know who should be where? And you know what a matchmaker is, right? So this woman was a matchmaker, and she heard this lament of this guy in town who was looking for a girlfriend. He was even looking for a wife. And he was saying, aren't there any beautiful women here who are smart and really, you know, he just had not found the right girl. And so this matchmaker said, I know just the person. This Coretta Scott King, she's in the Conservatory of Music. She sings. Everybody says she sings like an angel. So they got it going. He called her, and she told him where she was staying. And he said, I usually can get there in 7 minutes, but I'll get there in 5 minutes, you know. And her heart is pumping. Oh, my God, and I'm going to meet this guy that they have pumped up. And then he drove up, and here's this short guy. Goodness, you know, her heart just went down, you know. And he had shaved all his hair off because he was pledging Alpha and he had to shave their hair. But they went out for dinner and they talked about social justice for some reason. She wanted things to change and he wanted things to change. And they had lots to talk about. And so they talked for 4 hours, and on the way home, he just stopped and stared at her. He said, you know what? You have everything I want in a wife. And she said, what? But it was love at first sight. I mean, this is what is so touching about the story of Coretta Scott King. Because they had, you know, you hear them, her, you know, singing and him preaching, but they loved each other. And this hostile, hateful system just tore their life apart. But that's how they met. And I would have to think that God had something to do with, she had the power to sing, he had the power to preach, and they got together, and she used her preaching voice for years to fund the movement because she would have concerts. And so, you know, the rest is history, but it was a divine.
What do you think was, there are many pivotal moments in the civil rights movement where she was present with her husband. Are there any that you think were more profound than others when she was present with him?
I just think the Montgomery bus boycott was the most profound, because I think he said, in fact, it's on my book, he said, if I had not had a wife with the fortitude, strength, and calmness of Coretta, I could not have stood amid the ordeals and tension Coretta proved to be the type of wife with qualities to make a husband when he could have been so easily broken. I think that was the, because I should say that he said, Dr. King said, if she had left the movement when her father told her she had to leave Montgomery, he would have left. And if he had left, we don't know if there ever had, would have been Montgomery movement. And Montgomery movement was the mother of all the other movements. Selma, Birmingham, all the rest of them came after Montgomery. So I think that one was the most crucial where they would be. And they learned to be a team because he was not, she was first a peace advocate. She was going around the world pleading for peace. She went to the Geneva conference. She had delegations of Russian ladies to come and talk. And she talked to, she was very outspoken against the Vietnam War. And Dr. King was not. And so she actually influenced him to come against the Vietnam War, which he did a year before his death. So she had influence on him.
So you talk about their love and their passion, and he knew she would be his wife within 4 hours of them meeting, and all of her involvement. In the interviewing her, did you ask her about the other side? Because we know in the public sphere that there was much said about infidelity on his part. Did she talk about that?
Right, she did. It was, there were reports that he had affairs with other women. And one of them came out right before he was to take the Nobel Peace Prize. And we found that J. Edgar Hoover was behind sending out a letter, and in fact, a letter and tape that came to the house. And they had said this tape had proof that he was having an affair at this hotel. And so they played the tape. And nowhere on the tape was Dr. King's voice or anything else. That was just, you know, you talk about fake news now. Fake news just did not start now. We've had fake news for a long time. She said, a woman knows when the husbands are unfaithful. We know. And I can vouch for him. I believe he was true. And she said, who would people believe, really? Should they believe Hoover and the people who spread those vicious rumors? Or should they believe me? Let the public decide. Of course, I had no problem believing that she believed that. And I'm going to tell you, a memoir, let's just say something about that, because a memoir, I don't think I'll write another one because it's just too hard. Because you cannot think like you think. It's not your thoughts. You have to take what that person believes and make it as coherent and clear from the way they think. And that's very hard because the first time I wrote it, it was rejected because I wrote a biography. See, I had written a biography about Jesse Jackson, my bishop, Alfred Owens. But a memoirs cannot write as if you're looking at it. You've got to get into the person. She was very genteel, very forgiving. You know, she has so much dignity. You cannot write about someone like you want to write about them. You have, even if you disagree with what they think, it's not your business to disagree. You see what I'm saying? It's your business to state clearly what they believe. So it was very difficult because I had to learn to get rid of Barbara. And that was hard because I always have been very opinionated. It's like he is, you know. And it was hard to step aside to do this. But that's what you have to do to do a memoir.
What most surprised you about Mrs. King as you were interviewing her and putting this memoir together? What was the most surprising thing to learn about her?
I think that we saw her as a great woman. She came like a very stoic person, but she was very compassionate. You know, if she heard that somebody had been burnt out, she would get furniture and stuff to them. You know, she took care of her mother. I mean, she had a center with, what, about maybe 300 or 400 employees flying around the world. But she She had hands on when her mother was sick. She got her from Marion, Alabama, brought her home, nursed her. Her father's sick. She got him, nursed him. And some of the things that people just did not know, like when they were going to have the first election in South Africa, she had a team of nonviolent specialists that went to South Africa to prepare the people there to have a nonviolent election. So when Mandela won, you could see her dancing the toto on that night that they won. But she was so sometimes quietly intervening in situations because, see, nonviolence was her specialty. She taught it. She trained policemen. She would have you come to the center and she'd have the Crips and the Bloods there, you know, teaching them nonviolence, which you wouldn't think that this woman was doing this, but the coverage about her was always, it was not sufficient. The news people did not. And I'll tell you just one thing that was incredible, because these are some of the last things she told me. I think most people in here and around the world just do not know that they actually did have a trial in Memphis to see who killed Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. They had a civil trial where the man across the street who had a restaurant, he talked about how the mafia paid $100,000 to designate a shooter. The shooter was from the Memphis Police Department, and how after Dr. King was shot, the gun was dispatched right there at his place, and James Earl Ray did not shoot Dr. Martin Luther King. This trial went on for a couple of weeks. They talked about how Dr. King had two people who would be there for him. They were a detective and a fire person, and on the day of his assassination, they reassigned these people not to be there to protect him. And there's so many things that she said, you know, if you don't tell who killed my husband, it can happen again. But we don't talk about it. We have different salutes to him. I have a dream speech. But this has to be more than I have a dream speech. And in my closing, I also want to say, here's something else we should think about. She just had her 90th birthday, and we celebrate her birthday on his birthday. And I think it's a shame that we don't celebrate her on her own birthday.
Can I ask you a question as we prepare to take questions from the audience in a few minutes? You began talking about the sitting president of the United States and what was going on with him and in Washington. What would Coretta say to President Donald Trump in the midst of what do you think, as this Christian principled woman, what would be her words to President Trump?
She called on every president of her generation. And she would say, Mr. Trump, you are president of all Americans, and I expect you to be the president, not just of this little group here, but of all of us. She'd say it with much more dignity and clarity than I'm saying it. And if there was not, she would have a plan and a strategy, because she was a coalition leader. When I saw her visit people in high places like presidents, it wasn't for a photo shoot. It wasn't so that she could come out and stand there like they do and just smile. She would have an agenda, and then she would say, and who is assigned to this point and this point? And she would have follow-up. But she would be very, very vigorous in trying to help Trump be the man he should be. I think she would do that.
Do you think that Mrs. King could have been the first female president?
I don't think so. And the reason, if you can see how nasty this election was, she stopped even campaigning for people because she said she couldn't bear to say something unkind about them. It didn't have enough dignity for her to be involved in. So this is not she was a class act. This is just a big brawl, and I don't think she wanted to be involved in it.
So in chapter 13 of the book, around securing the right to vote was a blood covenant. She talks about when she was asked to speak at the concert and she tried to beg off, but Martin and Harry Belafonte insisted that she speak. Put that into context for us around her involvement in moving voters' rights forward.
Well, I think that she knew that if we did not have the right to vote, things would be just like they were when she was at Marion. When you think of Judge Sessions, you realize that there was a letter that this seemed to bubble up from the grave she was speaking again, saying this meant he tried to arrest and prosecute people in Marion, Alabama, who were just trying to vote. People like this should not be leaders. So she would be very much into the voting rights thing because she watched people being killed, watched people die, Medgar Evers and Evers, to give us the right to vote. And for us not to use it, it's almost sacrilegious.
Wonderful.